Okay, good afternoon, everybody. Today is Wednesday, August 7th, and we are here at United Orthodox Synagogues in Houston, Texas, for our weekly lunch and learn. And today we're going to do something a little different. We're going to focus on a Tisha B'Av theme, one of the keynote for Tisha B'Av. It occurred to me that we never have a chance to study any of these in depth. And so I thought we would do that today. So the keynote they're called elegies, I think, in English. And they are poetic dirges which refer to a number of different historical events. Of course, the event that we're most focused on Tisha B'Av is the destruction of both temples in Jerusalem. But if you come to shul on Sunday morning and you follow along with the keynote, you'll note that there are keynote for a number of things that are not directly related to the temple or the time of the temple. So for example, we have keynote from the times of the Crusades, talking about the book burnings. We have keynote talking about the destruction of certain cities in Germany during the Crusades. Obviously, we add keynote on Tisha B'Av about the Holocaust. Even though we have Yom HaShoah, we add an additional keynote for the Holocaust. So not everything, as you noticed, as I just mentioned, that we do on Tisha B'Av is related to the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. And the one that we're going to talk about now is also not directly related to the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. It is the Kina, which you find on page 102. This Kina was written by Rabbi Eliezer HaKalir. He is the author of most of the keynote. And I think it's worthwhile sharing some introductory remarks about Eliezer HaKalir, who he was, and the impact he had on Jewish liturgy. And the things I'm saying today are from a really wonderful volume by Rabbi Soloveitchik called The Lord is Righteous in All His Ways, Reflections on the Tisha B'Av Keynote. For those watching at home, here's the book. Okay. And he has basically, this book is broken up into two parts, themes of Tisha B'Av and themes of the keynote. And in the first chapter of the section on themes of the keynote, Rabbi Soloveitchik discusses a little bit about Rabbi Elazar HaKalir, who he was. So actually, Rabbi Soloveitchik floats a number of theories as to who he was and when he lived and where he lived. He suggests that he could have been the same person that we know as Rabbi Elazar HaGadol, who was a Tana, or Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus. We don't know exactly when he lived, but it could have been that he was the 6th or 7th century. Some suggest the 10th century, so past the period of the Tanaim. He is mentioned by name in the Tosfot. In fact, the Tosfot quotes some of the Piyutim, some of the liturgical prayers, which were written by Rabbi Elazar HaKalir. Rabbi Soloveitchik suggests that there may be proof from his own writings, from Rabbi Elazar HaKalir's own writings, that he lived in the 10th century based on 900 years, meaning 900 years from the destruction of the temple. So there are all sorts of hints in his own writing and the use of language that he uses and how other people quote him as to exactly who he is, when he lived. If you see on the top of page 102, it says by Kalir and it has 7th century question mark because it's not 100% clear exactly when he lived. So that's the debate about when he lived. Rabbi Soloveitchik assumes that Rabbi Elazar HaKalir lived in Israel. And this is, his proof is interesting. Rabbi, besides writing keynote, he also wrote, as I said, piyutim. Piyutim are, we say a lot of them on Rosh Hashanah. We're most familiar with them on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, but they exist for all the different holidays. No, you have the right book, page 102.
Is that in English?
Yeah, in English.
I don't have. Oh, wait a minute. Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah, and then
I'm
the Hebrew is. Yeah, the Hebrew and English are the same numbers. The Hebrew number and the English number are the same. You got it. Okay, perfect. So Rabbi Soloveitchik suggests that Rabbi Elazar HaKalir lived in Israel because he did not write a piyut for the second day of Rosh Hashanah. And apparently did not observe the second day of Rosh Hashanah. Now, of course, we know today in modern times in Israel, they also celebrate 2 days of Rosh Hashanah. But some Rishonim, some commentaries on the Talmud, use this as a proof that in Rabbi Elazar HaKalir's day, they only observed Rosh Hashanah for 1 day in Israel and not 2 days. That is not the custom now, but that's just an interesting historical tidbit. But Rabbi Soloveitchik is, based on this and other things, is convinced that he lived in Eretz Yisrael. And then he notes that Rabbi Elazar HaKalir's Piyutim essentially are compilations of statements found in the rabbinic writings and the writings of Chazal. And the question is not so much about the keynote, but just in general about Piyutim, just another very interesting historical note that Rabbi Soloveitchik explains is why were these piyutim created, right? Why were these liturgical poems added into the davening during this period of time? So Rabbi Soloveitchik writes the following, and this is really very interesting. He writes, "It is quite possible that Kalir introduced his piyutim during the Roman or Byzantine domination of Eretz Yisrael, when there was a royal decree against studying Torah Sheba'al Peh, the oral law. It was a time of religious persecution because Rome realized that as long as the Jews studied Torah, they would always be an independent people and it would be impossible to subdue them. They used to send officers into the shul on Yom Tov afternoons to enforce their prohibition against classes or sermons or any study assembly. As a result, the rabbis integrated the study of Torah Sheba Al Peh, meaning through these piyutim, into prayers via piyutim, something that did not occur to the Romans. They thought the Jews were just praying, but really they weren't. They were praying, but the prayers were teachings of the oral law about the holidays, about Midrashim, which were reworked into the fancy Hebrew that Rabbi Elazar HaKalir used, and that went unnoticed, according to Rabbi Soloveitchik, by the Romans at that time. So it was a clever way to get Torah study in under the radar of the Romans under the guise of praying.
The Romans will understand this. How could they differentiate between the study the Bible or the study?
Because they were able to recognize if it's in the context of a prayer service. So it was in the context of a prayer service these things are being read. But when the prayer service is ended, they kicked the Jews out and said, you can't come back to study Torah. So there was no way for them to study Torah. So they stuck it in to the prayer service, right? That's why. And it's possible, I don't know, it is possible that the Romans understood Hebrew. They had some experts, some traders, or some people who were able to tell them what the Jews were doing. I'm not sure about that, but it's feasible. Right, we know at least one. We know at least one Jew who worked for the Romans, Josephus. Right.
Dreidel concept, right?
Right, dreidel concept, exactly, right.
Dreidel is supposed to teach kids, according
to our tradition,
alphabet, decree, illiteracy
among Jews, they would be able to read. Right, okay. So that's a little bit about him. He also goes on to talk about how he modernized, that he was a master of the Hebrew language, and he modernized the Hebrew, and so many things that he did in Hebrew back then served as models and foundations for the growth of modern Hebrew even to this day. His language is very difficult, and he had critics. Some say what he did was just too difficult, and we shouldn't use those piyutim in the davening. Rabbi Soloveitchik, though, insists that he gave the language flexibility and really expanded the use of Hebrew language in a way that no one had done up until his time. And he really, he's the author of many, many of the piyutim, of the keynote that we have in our book. Just one other paragraph by Rabbi Soloveitchik about this. As the keynote we recite indicate, if Kalir had wanted to write plain Hebrew that even children could understand, he could have. The earlier keynote are difficult because they were written for scholars, but as the keynote progressed, Kalir's language becomes much simpler. In fact, his language is generally simpler and more understandable in the keynote than any of his other piyutim. One would think that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi wrote some of them, or maybe Ibn Ezra, or Colonimus, or Paitanim of Germany and France, who wrote in easier words. Apparently, Kalir did this purposely so that the people would understand at least some of what he was writing. Otherwise, it would not be keynote, right? The whole purpose is to feel bad and to feel sadness on Tisha B'Av, and if you don't understand what you're reading, that defeats the purposes. Okay, so that's a little bit just about his methodology and who he was and where he lived. And now we get to this particular kina. So this kina on page 102 starts with as follows. Vayikonen Yirmiyahu al Yoshiyahu. Okay, which is translated on top of the page adjacent to it. And Jeremiah lamented Josiah. Okay, everyone have that? Top of page 102. Okay, it's in brackets. Yeah, okay. Everyone have it? Okay. So what is this? This is a eulogy, right? This is a eulogy for King Yoshiyahu, written by Yirmiyahu. If you flip back to the other page. This is not the eulogy, actually. This is devoted to the eulogy. This is about the eulogy. The actual eulogy, according to Rashi, and Rabbi Soloveitchik quotes Rashi, was written by Yirmiyahu, and it is chapter 4 of Eicha. Right? We're going to read Eicha on Saturday night, and the entire chapter is a eulogy by Yirmiyahu about Yoshiyahu. So, one question we have to ask ourselves here is why, right? Why do we have a kina? Let's just talk about it that way. Why do we have one of these dirges that we say on Tisha B'Av about an individual, right? About king, about this king. What was unique about him that led us to include him in the keynote for Tisha B'Av. You want to take a stab at that?
He's probably the most greatest figure among Jewish kings.
Could be, yes.
Historically, he took his reign time in 640, and he died in 609. And Tanakh teaches us that in his time, so-called Torah book, his book, Dvarim, were discovered
right.
In the temple. But with his death, which he died in the battle, we know that next kings who took after him, they were going low and low at the level of understand political situation. Josiah actually expanded land of Judea.
Okay,
the Jews,
right.
Under him, they felt very
excellent.
Much
okay, rising. Good.
We don't know enough about him just to set up probably a real story.
Okay, good. So you're right. He was a great king, one of the greatest, and we'll see something about that in a moment. So as I mentioned before, so the keynote relate to the physical destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. They talk about the spiritual destruction that took place at that time. And now we're talking about the death of a single person. So Rabbi Soloveitchik notes that King Yoshiyahu was an excellent and outstanding king of Israel, and he writes, with the exception of David, there was none like him, which is interesting. We don't have a kina for David. But the difference is Yoshiyahu died in battle, and we'll get to that in a few minutes. He was 8 years old when he was crowned as king, and Rabbi Soloveitchik says he made no mistakes, although except for the last one. He made one mistake, and it cost him his life. But he was almost a perfect king, and in this kina, it praises Yoshiyahu by associating him with Moshe. Right? At one point, it says in this kina, none arose like him since the days of Avigdor. Avigdor is Moshe. It's another one of the names. There are lots of names that the rabbis tell us that Moshe had. Avigdor is one of the names for Moshe. So according to this kina, not since the days of Moshe, or maybe David, was there anyone like him? And the question is, what was so? What's that? You're welcome. You're welcome. It's brought down in the rabbinic in Chazal, in the rabbinic literature. His name was, he also had Tuvia. Tuvia also was another. Tuvia was another name of Moshe. Yeah. Okay. So the question is, what was so special about him? And Rabbi Soloveitchik notes that he combined two qualities. One of them, you mentioned, Zach. Well, first, he was the king. He was a great king, like Moshe was. Like Moshe is considered to be like a king in rabbinic literature, like Moshe was. But not only was he a great king, he was also what Rabbi Soloveitchik calls Rabban Shel Yisrael. He was the teacher, right? He brought Torah back, as you said, to the Jewish people. And so he played both roles, unlike anyone had played both of those roles together since the time of Moshe. He destroyed idolatry in Eretz Yisrael, and therefore he purified Eretz Yisrael. And so it's similar to what Moshe did, right? Moshe destroyed the golden calf, right? Destroyed the idolatry that was amongst Bnei Yisrael, and this king destroyed the idolatry that was amongst Bnei Yisrael at his time. So there's also something else that is ascribed here to Yoshiyahu. It says the Paitan ascribes to Yoshiyahu something that was characteristic of someone else. I'll ask you who it was. He was 3 years old when he acknowledged his creator. So who was that? According to the Midrash and others, Avraham. Right? Avraham, according to the Midrash, acknowledged that there was only one God when he was 3 years old. And here, Rabbi Elazar HaKalir ascribes the same thing to Moshe. And the Rambam writes that Avraham had no teacher, no one blazed the trail for him. Everyone around him was engulfed in idolatry. His father and mother were completely involved and committed to idolatry. Even Avraham was an idolater for some time. Whatever he discovered, whatever he found, he did by himself. And so similarly, here we're saying the same, and this attribute, the same praiseworthy qualities also apply to Yoshiyahu. He too achieved greatness on his own, though in his case at the age of 8, not 3. Okay? So it's a similar, so we have these parallels. Rabbi Soloveitchik is trying to point out these parallels, right? We're comparing Yoshiyahu to Moshe and Avraham, right? To the two great, if not greatest, right, heroes of the Torah, and Yoshiyahu is right up there with them, according to Rabbi Soloveitchik. Yes, Zach.
King Josiah deserved his praise. He was a great politician. He took power at the time when Assyrian empire collapsed and new power of New Babylonian kingdom and Egypt.
Egypt. Well, that's a great,
He found a way how to maneuver.
Until the end.
Yes.
Until the end. And we're going to get to that now.
It's our story. We always put in between.
Right. Exactly. So how did he die? So Rabbi Soloveitchik writes, with all his greatness, he was killed in the Battle of Megiddo. And this story is told in the Book of Kings, Kings 2, chapter 23. And the story was that the Egyptian king, Paro Necho, declared war on Bavel, on Babylon. But between Bavel and Egypt
is Israel.
Right? So he requested permission just to march through Israel so he can get to Bavel. Okay? And, right? Paro Necho declared war on Bavel and wanted the permission of Yoshiyahu to allow his army to cross Eretz Yisrael on its way to Mesopotamia, to what today we call Syria or Lebanon. Okay? Egypt would not have engaged Israel in warfare. That was not the intention of Paro Necho. He simply wanted free passage. And then, according to the Midrash, there was a debate between Yirmiyahu and Yoshiyahu as to whether or not to allow the Egyptians passage. And what they were arguing about was a verse in Vayikra that says, a sword shall not cross your land. A sword shall not cross your land. Yirmiyahu interpreted it as only applying to an enemy in a type of war, in a time of war. Meaning if an army wants to pass through with peaceful intentions, you should let them.
Okay,
that's what Yirmiyahu said. Yoshiyahu said, no, it means we're never supposed to allow an enemy into the land. Right, so he said we're never allowed to do it. Yirmiyahu thought that it would be wise to give peaceful passage to Pharaoh. His opinion was that Israel would remain friends with Paro, which was going to neutralize Assyria. Right? He had his own sort of read of the Torah, plus his political strategic read of the land. On the other hand, Yoshiyahu interpreted the verse differently, meaning no sword, even a sword of peace, can pass through the land, and he didn't want to allow them, even for your allies. And plus, he wanted to be on friendly terms with Bavel, who was a rising power. And he thought that by stopping Bavel, by stopping Egypt from entering into the land of Israel, that Bavel would now all of a sudden ally themselves or be more friendly towards Israel. This, of course, did not happen. He did not gain their sympathy. And at the same time, he alienated Egypt. So he lost on both. So he antagonized them. And then they got in the middle of this war between Syria and Egypt. And he was killed in the famous Battle of Megiddo. So that was, according to Rabbi Soloveitchik, his one and only mistake that he made. Now, what's interesting, Rabbi Soloveitchik then goes on to a very interesting theological question, which I actually touched on last Shabbat when I talked about the partial blame that the Kohen Gadol has when there's an accidental killing and someone has to go to an Ir Miklat. If you remember, an Ir Miklat is a city of refuge. And the only way for the accidental killer to get out of the Ir Miklat is the Kohen Gadol's death. And so this led to the strange situation where the mother of the Kohen Gadol would provide clothing and food to the accidental murderers so that they would not pray for her son's death. Right? Very strange. So then the Gemara asks an interesting question. Is it possible that this Kohen Gadol, who was blameless, is going to die because people prayed for him to die? He didn't do anything wrong. So God would say, well, this person is completely innocent, but since you prayed for his death, I'm going to kill him. That doesn't make any sense. So the Gemara answers, well, the Kohen Gadol is not completely innocent. Since he was the leader of the time, He should have prayed, which I read this as a little bit more. He should have done what he had to do to correct the society. Meaning, if there's an accidental murderer or accidental murders happening, it means people are being negligent, people aren't being careful, people are being flippant with human life and with the way they interact with each other. They're not being careful about the way they drive. That's the leader's responsibility. And so even though he didn't kill anyone with his hands, I think what the Gemara is trying to tell us is the leader bears some responsibility for these type of activities that happen in society. So with that in mind, Rabbi Soloveitchik asks a question. If Yoshiyahu had no sin, why was he punished? And he died a horrible death, right? He died a death wherein the Gemara tells us his body was punctured like a sieve, right? He died a horrible death. So now we know he made a mistake in his calculation and his debate with Yirmiyahu, but why would he have to die such a horrible death, right? What did he do wrong to deserve such a horrible death? So one answer is it wasn't a punishment. He got in the middle of a war, and that's what happens when you get in the middle of a war. Sometimes you get killed, especially if you're the king. And especially if you're the king, they're going to want to make an example out of you, and they're going to really punish you. And that happens, and maybe it wasn't a punishment per se. However, when he was dying, according to the Midrash and according to the Gemara, he admitted sin. He said, I disobeyed God's word. So maybe he was admitting that he made a mistake with Yirmiyahu, and he let some other factor get in the way of his decision-making. But Rabbi Soloveitchik has a really interesting take on this. And he asks, if no one else since the days of Moses was able to achieve the same stature of Yoshiyahu, why was he killed? After all, he was a great man, a saint who did everything possible and successfully and completely eradicated idolatry from the entire Eretz Yisrael. What did he do wrong? Anyone want to take a stab at that?
Well, we already discussed. You're not supposed to ask the question that why he was killed.
That's true. That's true. But nonetheless, Rabbi Soloveitchik attempts to answer it along the lines of the Kohen Gadol that I talked about by suggesting as follows. He says that Yoshiyahu was, this is theologically complicated, but I think there's an important lesson nonetheless. The answer is that he was a sacrifice that God demanded for the sins committed by his contemporaries. Well, let's see. Rabbi Soloveitchik doesn't call it quite that. He calls it something else. The sin of the wicked ones of his generation cleaved to him. That's what it says in the Piyut. In spite of all his accomplishments, the Midrash says that the people of his time could not be completely torn away from idol worship. Meaning he did a lot of great things, but he didn't finish it. They did not worship idols publicly because Yoshiyahu had destroyed all their temples, their shrines, their cultic sites, but they used to hide it and fool him, worshiping clandestinely behind closed doors. King Yoshiyahu, like any Melech Yisrael, was responsible for every sin of his people, even if the sin was not known to him. And this is the key point. A leader is responsible for the sins of his community, even for matters of which he is not aware, and which therefore he cannot correct. There is no mitigating circumstance that may save the leader from being punished. He should have known he was, after all, a Melech Yisrael. Right? It's setting an incredibly high bar, right, for the king of Israel, that he has to be so influential, right, that even people won't even sin privately, that they've been inspired so much by the king's example that they won't even sin privately. And that's exactly what Rabbi Soloveitchik says. Here one sees how enormous and how frightening is the responsibility of the Jewish leader. If the anointed priest should sin, bringing guilt upon the people, he is responsible not only for sins committed by the people in public that he can eliminate or change, but even for those committed clandestinely. Sometimes the leader is the sacrifice or offering that God demands from the generation. This is the principle of the death of the righteous is an atonement, which is a theme that comes up over and over again in keynote, because we talk about the Asara Haruge Malchut, right? The 10 martyrs come up in the keynote, and this comes up in the keynote, and there's the destruction of the cities of the Kohanim that come up in the keynote. As the king, Yoshiyahu was responsible for many things for which we would not have been held responsible. Responsibility is measured always by the greatness of the person. The smaller, ordinary person is not as responsible as the great person. We have already seen this in the context of the sin committed by Moshe, right? Moshe's little tiny sin of hitting the rock, according to, you know, one of our traditions, one of the way we understand that whole story, that little tiny sin is what disqualified him from being able to enter the land of Israel. A tiny thing, even though he had already been told to hit the rock a different time, right? But he's such a great man. This is the Jewish version of the bigger they are, the harder they fall, right? The bigger tzaddik you are, then you are judged with a very, very fine tooth comb, and there could be very, very disturbing consequences. It's a tough one. I agree. That is a hard one. It's a hard one to swallow. Just one other note to directly answer the question. Zach gave a good answer, or Soloveitchik's answer to the question is, but why do we designate a special kina to commemorate the death of Yoshiyahu? Meaning, all this is true. He was compared to Moses and Avram. He was a great king, and he made a strategy error when it came to his debate with Yirmiyahu, and he wasn't punished for his own sins. He was only punished for everyone else's sins. But why do we have? What's he doing in the middle of Tisha B'Av? So true, a great man was killed, but how can it be compared to the Churban Beit HaMikdash? It's one, even if it's a great person. It's one person. There is this. When it came to the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, there a city was raised, a country destroyed, a Beit HaMikdash turned into ruins, independence taken away, an entire nation affected. On Tisha B'Av, we focus on national catastrophes and national disasters in which hundreds of thousands were killed and exterminated. We discuss events that reflect the absolute determination on the part of our enemies to destroy us completely as a people. So again, he's just adding to the question. Right, we were talking about the most terrible things that ever happened in the history of our people. How can we talk about one guy, no matter how wonderful he was? So he answers. But now the answer should be obvious. The reason is that on Tisha B'Av we mourn not only for the physical destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, but also for the destruction or death of an individual, a Gavra Rabba, a great person. That is as tragic as the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, and perhaps even more so. The book of Eicha would not have been complete had it not contained a eulogy, not only for Zion, but for King Yoshiyahu. Jeremiah was writing the story of the Churban Beit HaMikdash, discussing the complete destruction of the land and the death of the huge number of people, mourning and grieving. But at the same time, he did not forget to append to Eicha, the fourth chapter, the eulogy that he delivered for Yoshiyahu. After he got through the first three chapters of Eicha, in which he described the national tragedy, Yirmiyahu began to speak about Yoshiyahu, delivering a eulogy for an individual. An individual is just as important and as deserving of grieving and mourning and keynote as the national Churban Beit HaMikdash. So this is actually very interesting. It's true that it's written about a great person, but you can make the same argument about anybody. Right? Every person is their own world. Every person really deserves that same type of mourning, all the more so a great person, but every person. Once again, the death of the righteous is equivalent to the burning of the house of our God, says the Gemara. When we lose a great man, a great scholar, a great leader, it is just like losing the Beit HaMikdash. I remember, actually, I was at a funeral once for the wife of the rabbi of my shul growing up. But he wasn't my rabbi. I left by the time he came in, and his wife died. She was very young. How old was she? In her 30s? In her 30s? In her 40s? She was very young. And her father, who happened to have been the rabbi of the emeritus of the shul that I was the rabbi of in Montreal, stood up to eulogize her, and he stood up and he said, I'm experiencing my own personal Churban Beit HaMikdash today. It was such, I never forget, it was such a powerful statement that's how devastated he was by that. By the way, we also have Rabbi Soloveitchik notes the day after Rosh Hashanah. What is the day after Rosh Hashanah? Tom Gedalia. We fast for one guy. Now, it's true, it represents the loss of Eretz Yisrael, but it's called Tzom Gedalia. The other fasts are for national destruction. This is for one person. So we have mixed in to our tradition this notion that national destruction is terrible, and we talk about it in the Shoah, right? But what ultimately happened in the Shoah? 6 million individual people were murdered. Not 6 million. It's not a group of people. It's one person, six million times, right? For me, the most powerful, the most powerful way to experience this is when you go to Yad Vashem and you go into the children's memorial, right? When you go in, there's a candle that's reflected to look like it's many candles. And what do you hear?
Names.
Just names. A million children were killed in the Shoah. You hear a million names, just names, right? That's the whole point, right? So I think that's very important as we think about Tisha B'Av, that it's the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, of Jerusalem, of the cities of the Kohanim. It's the loss of Eretz Yisrael. It's exile. And it's also the loss of people, of individual people. And Yoshiyahu is just as an example of how we're supposed to feel when a great person, and I guess that may be a subjective category, right? When a great person dies or is killed, especially in the way he was killed, we are also supposed to mourn that as well. Yeah.
I can't stop myself not to mention something. It's a huge secular.
It's a huge what?
It's a huge secular point, or let's talk about political point. The Midrashic you mentioned about discussion between. King Josiah,
Yirmiyahu and Yoshiyahu?
Jeremiah,
yeah.
Was really showing splitting a country between party for Egypt and party for newborn Babylonian kingdom.
Right.
And if you follow those political path, you can see, started from Pharaoh Necho, up to the last point, which happened with the depression of Beit HaMikdash, Jews did not learn how to make constructive from their political argument. I surprised how much Tanakh showed us what we have in Israel in our day.
Yeah.
It's actually our nature. If you remember,